Hello and welcome to All About Symbian Insight number 26. It's a welcome from me, Steve Litchfield, here in Reading, from...
Me, Rafe Blanford in Sussex.
And from Stefan from intomobile.com.
In Finland. Okay, before we get started, some news. From the outside of the Symbian world, just for a change, you may have heard on the grapevine that Apple are launching something rather major in a couple of weeks. There's what's expected is a 3G iPhone, possibly with GPS as well. It looks pretty exciting with their built-in App Store, which is a bit like Nokia's download, only on speed, and also providing a much easier way of getting freeware applications into users' hands. So a lot of people are eyeing that up, and I think that'll be a big competitor for what Nokia have in planned over the next 12 months. There's also HTC have just launched their Touch Diamond, which is an iPhone-like device, but with full Windows Mobile, and its main selling point is that it's got a glitzy animated UI, which I have my doubts about. I think maybe, Stefan, you had some thoughts on the Touch Diamond?
Well, yes, it is an extremely flashy user interface, but honestly, that's what people are going to walk into the shop, and they're going to see it, and then they're going to purchase it without actually understanding that, okay, after about 45 seconds, the user interface is completely useless. So while it isn't efficient, it will help sell. And actually, the CEO of HTC said that they plan to push 3 million of these phones out by the end of 2008.
Yeah, that's a pretty ambitious target. I have my doubts. I think Rafe, you're a bit more confident. Have you got any thoughts about the Touch Diamond?
Yeah, I mean, I'm more confident on those numbers. I do expect them to do a couple of variants of this. So at the moment, it's 8 gigabytes of internal memory. I'm sure we'll see one with a sort of memory card slot. And if you recall the HTC Touch, which is basically the predecessor of the Diamond, they launched the Touch Dual about 6 months after the launch of the original Touch, and that had a slide-out keyboard, and I imagine we'll see something similar from the Diamond, and that'll help them get to 3 million. But it's also interesting to note that HTC has excellent relations with operator partners. And you often see the HTC devices get rebranded as the Orange something or other, or the T-Mobile whatever, and Vodafone as well, and many other operators around the world. So that's crucial for them in terms of getting sales, because their own name brand, HTC, is really still only just getting started. And actually, I think you can draw an interesting comparison with the iPhone there, where it's the other way around there, or rather the relationships with the operators tend to be far more favouring Apple one-sided. You know, there's no rebranding, obviously, and some of the things they put in place very much favour Apple in terms of getting a portion of the contract in many cases, and indeed some of those terms haven't come out, so we're not absolutely sure. But actually it's quite interesting, because HTC and Apple have sold a very similar number of devices and launched at a similar time with the Touch and now the Diamond and the Apple iPhone 3G, and it's just contrasting strategies. Yet of course all the attention has been on the iPhone, yet in its own way the HTC Touch has been just as successful.
Yeah, there's also the BlackBerry Bold, just to throw that into the mix as well. It's interesting seeing all these sort of next-gen flagship handsets coming out with fairly similar form factors. Now, the BlackBerry Bold has got a QWERTY keyboard, Nokia E61 style, but for a BlackBerry, it actually rolls in all the things, goodies like GPS and Wi-Fi, that have never really been under one suit, one case before. So there'll be the three non-Symbian devices, the iPhone, Touch Diamond family, and the BlackBerry Bold, that I'd really highlight as ones to watch over certainly the next 6 months. And just a small anecdote about Apple and their iPhone. A lot has been said about Apple and the way their technology just works, even if it's not quite cutting edge always. I was around a friend's house the other day. He just bought a Mac Mini in America. He'd brought it across here. No keyboard, no screen, no mouse. He said, "Will you please do something with it and connect it up for me?" I plugged in an old PC keyboard, an old PC mouse, and within 5 seconds of turning it on, it was asking me to press a couple of keys on the keyboard so it could identify the keyboard. Within 1 minute of turning it on for the very first time, it was on. We were surfing the web with mouse and keyboard, and there's just a Windows Vista box, for example. You would have been talking 10 minutes to half an hour at least. I was just tremendously impressed by how well the Apple hardware worked and how well the Apple software worked. And I suspect it's going to be very similar with the iPhone and the Apple software inside that. I'm really looking forward to having a play with that. And although I'm a bit of a Symbian, I won't use the word fanboy, a Symbian specialist, I really admire what Apple are doing on that side of things. And it'd be fascinating comparing all three or all four platforms as the year goes on. Okay. Moving on now, we've got the S60 Summit, which starts tomorrow, Rafe. I believe you're jetting off to Barcelona?
Yes, indeed. We're, of course, recording this in advance. But yes, by the time this comes out, the S60 Summit will be starting on the Wednesday and also run through some of Thursday morning as well. The S60 Summit, it's worth explaining, is really a business-to-business conference, so partners from the S60 ecosystem and the S60 world all get together. It's a good chance to have meetings, to network, and of course there are various speeches and seminars going on as well, and you can expect to hear about how S60 is being used by operators, how S60 is being used by Samsung, and we'll be covering the event live on the site. It's quite possible we'll hear more about the next version of S60, you know, the S60 Touch stuff, and there may be some new devices from Samsung, but it's, as I say, there's also an opportunity for software vendors to show their stuff off in the expo arena. So it's a bit like you know, one of the trade shows that we go to, something like 3GSM, but just concentrated on S60. And as I said, it is a bit more specialist, but there should be some interesting bits and pieces coming out of the summit. I would imagine there'll be a few news announcements, but quite what they are yet, it's probably difficult to say.
Yeah. Also, it's worth noting that Ewan Spence from AAS is also going to be there at the summit, covering things, which is good. And Stefan, are you going to be at the S60 summit?
Sadly, I'm not. There was a conflict of schedule. We're actually going to have an evening with S60 in Boston, which we haven't announced yet. And I think I'm allowed to say, but even if I'm not, you know, it's fine. So I'm going to be in the States, and I couldn't come. So, sorry, guys.
Okay, we'll catch you on the next time. Okay, let's move on to another exciting project, the N78, which was launched a few months ago. Stefan's got hold of one of the very first production units. So what are your impressions so far?
Well, I had a hold of one. I actually was allowed to borrow one for about 12 hours, and it was final hardware shipping with final firmware, so it essentially is what people will be able to purchase on the shelves. As a phone itself, I was surprised by how small it was. It's the size of my N82, but it's thinner. The camera, the one thing that really struck me as amazing was how fast it could autofocus. Coming from an N95 and then heading over to an N82, the N78 is just extremely fast. As soon as you have pressed the shutter key, your image is practically focused. The audio quality out of the phone is fantastic. The one issue I was having is it wasn't playing any of my MP3s, and that's why I didn't want to post a full-on review. But of course, I found out that the problem was my memory card was corrupt. Anyway, after formatting that, everything worked. S60 3.2, it's easier and it's harder at the same time. The fact that there is a center soft key helps, but there are just tons more options inside your phone. There's a brand new settings menu in there called Events, and pretty much everything you can think about, from charging your phone to receiving an SMS to battery full, all of these events you can program either with a specific sound or a specific phrase to be spoken with the text-to-speech engine inside. As for the styling of the device, if you thought the N82 was a fingerprint magnet, the N78 is 20,000 times worse. This device attracts oil like no other phone I've seen in my life. I actually had to wipe it several times in order to touch the actual thing. The keypad is quite small, which I thought would be a problem, but after about 10 or 15 minutes, I got adjusted to it extremely fast. So it really isn't a problem, and I have large hands. What else should I comment on? Ah, yes, the screen is super, super bright. Brighter than my N82, brighter than my N95. This screen is absolutely crisp. And the audio quality, again, I can't emphasize, it is higher quality than my N82, which is saying a lot, because the N82 and N81 especially were quite up there.
So, Stefan, what I'm curious about is, do you think it's going to appeal more to sort of the, I wouldn't say the mid-tier, but the sort of lower upper end, because the N95 8GB can be a bit of an intimidating device for new people, and the N82 is, you know, quite expensive. I think the N78 will come in a bit cheaper, and to an extent it's looking to replace something like the N73. So do you think it's going to be more approachable in terms of getting the N-series into more people's hands?
Absolutely. It's actually the size of a phone, as opposed to the N95 8GB, which can be used as a blunt instrument. So I think it will sell quite large, and as a successor to the N73, I think they hit on all targets. It's got Wi-Fi, HSDPA, GPS, 3.5mm headphone jack. It essentially has everything. And I think it's 350 euros before taxes. I'm not sure on that. But in the shops, it should be free on contract, similar to what the N95 was. So I imagine it will sell a lot.
Okay. One thought about the keypad. Though my main worry is perhaps the size. I mean, see, if size is an issue, if you've used anything like the larger keypads and things like the Nokia N93, the Nokia E90 on the external cover phone, I really like having the physical size and the luxury of moving my fingers around. But my biggest worry on the N78 keypad is the fact that the legends are all completely black. They're black on black. It reminds me of that scene in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where you have a black light lights up with a black key legend on a black console to tell you you've done something. On the N78, how is it going to perform outdoors? I'm guessing, Stefan, you just play with it indoors?
Yes, because by the time I did bring the phone outside, it was already nightfall, so I didn't have any problems with the keypad, so I can't comment on that. But I would imagine it was probably going to be pretty bad, because, as you said, the keypad is all black, and the key legends aren't white, they're just clear. So I'm not really sure how visible that's going to be.
Okay, so we'll have to wait for a proper review unit for me to give that the full Steve Litchfield sunlight test, which is ironic, really, as I live in Britain. You don't get to see much sunlight, but there we go. Talking about the N95 as a blunt instrument, I have to challenge you there. I challenge you with your N95 to me with my Nokia E90. A blunt instrument against blunt instrument, I know who I would back. Although you are taller than me. Anyway, moving on. Discussion of the N-Gage. We can't move on from this insight without discussing the hot topic of the week. Rafe, do you want to just introduce what it was all about?
Yes, I'll just introduce this briefly. What we are going to talk about here is transferring N-Gage games from one handset to another. Now, the way it works when you buy an N-Gage game is that you get an activation code, and it's activated on your handset, and that happens regardless of whether you download it over the air or sideload it from a PC. And actually what that does is it locks it to that handset, and it means you can't use it on another handset. Now, originally, at the Go Play event where this N-Gage stuff was announced, we were told that it would be possible to transfer games to a new device, for example, when you upgrade or when you buy a new handset and just switch back and forth between the two. Obviously, that's something that's, you know, fairly key. And if we think about other systems that have, you know, kind of DRM in place, which I think everyone would probably accept is necessary as a anti-piracy measure, then you can swap. However, we did a bit of digging on All About N-Gage, and we found out that it's not actually possible to transfer your N-Gage games when you upgrade your phone. The only time it can happen is when your phone gets replaced under warranty by Nokia. Now, of course, that happens relatively scarcely. I mean, that happens if you've sent it in for warranty replacement, and that's the only way you'll get a transfer. And of course, if you break your phone or you lose it, won't be able to transfer the games. Now, naturally, we were a bit upset by this, and we think it's rather a mistake on the part of Nokia and Engage to not be able to transfer your games across. And so we posted an article about this on All About Engage, and there was quite a bit of feedback both on the site itself, and it was picked up right around the web on some of the big blogs and made it into mainstream media, both in the UK and Finland and elsewhere. And, you know, our main thesis was actually this is pretty damaging to the Engage platform, because one of the main reasons people might pick up Engage is because it's a much better experience than you currently have with mobile games. We're quite aware of the fact that, you know, with Java games you tend to lose them when you upgrade your handset, but we don't really expect this to happen when you're paying a little bit more for the games and it's part of a, you know, a seamless connected mobile gaming experience, as Engage is termed. And, you know, you may draw a contrast with something like Nokia Music, where, of course, you can take your tracks with you when you go onto a new device. So that's a quick summary of the situation.
Okay, I just thought to interject at this point that you don't actually necessarily lose your Java games once you move device, because there are very easy ways you can preserve them. See the All About Symbian support section for details. I've put up an FAQ there. But back on the subject of Engage, there's such an easy fix. You have this Engage account that everyone signs up for. Surely you just tie, it's an easy fix for them. You tie the games to the account and you keep your Engage client signed in with that account, and there's no possibility for piracy because you can't have multiple people logged in at the same account. Stefan, I'm sure you've got some strong views in all this. What are your opinions?
I have to echo exactly what you guys said. If you purchase a game, it should be tied to your account and you should be able to download it on whatever handset you own, because like you guys, I also have several handsets and I don't want to be choosing which handset I want to take out today based on which video game is on which handset, and that's just a pain, honestly.
I agree with Stefan there. Although, I mean, I think it's perhaps realistic to expect them to be locked to one handset at a time. What I don't think is realistic, especially when we're talking, you know, for most people, they're not necessarily going to have multiple devices. But, you know, obviously one of the driving forces I always thought behind Engage was actually it will encourage people to stay with Engage-compatible devices. And, of course, by locking it to a single handset, you lose all that. If you go to a new handset and you want to play the same games again, you'll actually have to buy them again. So, you know, say you've got six games that you really like, that could be another, you know, £40 or £50 that you have to spend to get your games back. And I'm sure that's going to be very unpopular, and basically, you know, people just aren't going to do it. And we've already seen some of the reaction online, people saying, you know, I'm not going to buy Engage games until this is fixed, or, you know, I'm seriously disappointed. And while, you know, the expectations just are not meeting the reality, and I really think Nokia would do well to fix this and get a statement out, even if it was just to say, yeah, we're aware of the problem, it's something we're working on, we just can't give you a timescale yet. And I should mention that, you know, when we were looking into this, we did make quite a considerable effort to contact Nokia and check what the official situation was, and, you know, we got the reply back that it's not transferable because of piracy concerns. And, you know, quite frankly, I was a bit surprised by this, but, you know, that's the situation as it currently stands.
Yeah, I think Nokia are probably hamstrung at this point, because these games have been in development now for 6 months to a year or so, and presumably hard-coded into these games. It is no code whatsoever for the game running specifically and explicitly under one Engage account. That's not something that was built into the design, even though when the Engage platform was launched, that was something that they said would happen. I don't believe that was actually necessarily there for the developers to tie into. So I think to have games which will run under this perhaps Engage account locking system that we're proposing, I think will take quite a while to work its way into the code base. Having said that, Rafe?
I was going to say, although despite that, Steve, the actual locking mechanism is done via activation codes, so it wouldn't be too difficult to say, okay, this person is transferring to a new handset, and we're going to reissue them activation codes for this IMEI number. The problem is, of course, they'll still be activated on the old handset, and I suspect that's where the problem comes in. However, I think, you know, there might be ways around that by saying, you know, you can only reactivate on a new IMEI once every 6 months or so, and as a temporary measure, I think people would be happy to accept that. Though, of course, I think you're right, in the longer term, it may take a little longer, because obviously what's going to be needed is some way of activating the games, but at the same time deactivating it on the old handset, as happens, I think, with iTunes at the moment.
Yeah, there's this whole balance between paranoia and DRM versus goodwill. And in this particular case, Nokia's concerns and paranoia and the implementation of DRM to this level has caused them immense badwill. And companies in the last 3 or 4 years have found this. And they make a mistake and this huge worldwide rumpus happens, which damages their brand and damages their product in the public eye to a huge extent. And surely 10,000 times worse than if they had allowed the possibility of piracy by, as you say, reissuing the codes to new IMEIs every 6 months or every 3 months, or just responding in response to user requests. When a guy says, I've changed my phone, help, they say, no problem, here's your download link, or we'll reissue a new reactivation code. Surely that's the level of hassle for them for doing that has got to be less than the incredible hassle they're going to have from this worldwide story going around the world. Stefan, any other thoughts?
Well, they say that it's there to prevent piracy, and I don't think that's it at all, because I don't think there is one piece of digital software in the world that has yet to be pirated and cracked and spread everywhere on the internet. So while it might work now, it probably won't within 6 months. And if they keep the system they have now, they're only going to be hurting users, because that's the whole point of DRM. It isn't about piracy. It's about hurting your fans, really.
Yeah, agreed. Rafe?
Well, I was just going to finally say what's interesting about this. From my point of view, we did actually think quite carefully about how to run this story and what tone to put it in. And I'd say that's partly why we wanted to get confirmation from Nokia, because we're aware that this is going to cause quite a reaction. Perhaps I didn't anticipate quite such a big one, but it's quite interesting from sitting at this end to see the reaction that spread out as a result of this one story on All About Engage. And while this has happened a little bit before with stuff we've written on All About Symbian, I think this is perhaps a hotter topic than most, and a good example of just how new media or social media, depending on how you want to define it, can actually have a very quick impact and spread out very quickly. And clearly there is something of a PR issue for Nokia to address now, because there are a lot of people now aware of this problem, and it has spread very quickly, and it's the power of the internet. And I think a lot of companies could learn from this kind of thing. And it's not, this happens all the time, and a lot of Microsoft PR blunders are very similar to this. And Nokia, as it becomes a software and services company, needs to be more and more aware of this kind of thing, because I think it will only become more of an issue as they get more and more into software and services. And as an internet company, they do need to be on top of these things. Now, I'm sure they're working on it already, but perhaps this could be a lesson for everybody within sort of the mobile world, that this sort of thing, I think, will happen more frequently now that we're dealing in an age where software and services rather than devices are becoming the most important thing.
Yeah, and I firmly agree with Stefan in terms of DRM and how DRM is evil. I do believe that you have to put measures in place to stop casual piracy, and you can do this through either tying things to a credit card account, to a specific user account, a username and password, etc. You don't have to make the objects themselves, the games, the music tracks, or whatever. The objects shouldn't be digitally locked. There should be some tie-in to an individual, so that the individual doesn't want their ID copied and copied across the internet. That's the way to go, as far as I'm concerned. Just moving smoothly into commercial models and DRM, I'd like to just talk briefly and get your guys' opinions on the way software can be sold. We're looking in terms of Nokia Mapsys specifically, which was released this week in a full V2.0 version, and I've been quite impressed by it. A lot of people seem to be very anti the Nokia Maps model, which I'll explain in a moment, and a lot of people seem to be very for it. I'm in the for category, I have to say. Basically, Nokia Maps, this full mapping system, navigation system, the mappings system complete with points of interest, is all completely free. Anyone can download it for any Nokia smartphone. If you then want to go beyond basic, here I am with the Bluetooth GPS and here are the things around me, if you want to go to it actually telling you how to get somewhere in terms of voice-guided navigation, you then pay. And it's a pay-as-you-go model. When they first started, they had some quite small granularity, things like 1 day, 3 days. I believe that's now been changed to something like 1 week, a month, and a year. Which is fair enough. But from my point of view, I'm a casual traveller. I spend most of my life in one place, but two or three times a year I go off to some interesting places around this country, not other countries, Ewan, just this country. and I want to know how to get there. So rather than have to pay £110 or £90 up front for a sat-nav suite from Company A and just have it sitting there doing nothing most of the time, but with my money effectively wasted, this time I can have Nokia maps on every handset I own, and whichever one I happen to be using that particular holiday, no problem. I'd say I want to get somewhere, and it pops up a message saying, you need to upgrade to navigation. Do you want 1 week, a month, or a year? I say, yes, please, I'll have a week. I pay my £4 via reverse SMS. It happens within 10 seconds. And 10 seconds later, I'm zooming off down the road. And for the rest of my week's holiday, I've got full voice guided navigation. I've only had to pay £4.50 or £6 or whatever it is. I think that's an ideal model for 98% of users. Who wants to go first? Rafe or Stefan?
I think I'll handle it. Because honestly, it really isn't an issue about price. It could be £1 for 1 week, and people will still feel compelled to use an application such as Google Maps because it is free, and it does pretty much most of what you need a software application to handle. And I'm in the against camp. I actually enjoy Nokia Maps 2.0 as a software program in the sense that it's quick and it looks very pretty, but the points of interest library is rubbish, and the navigation, you have to pay. And honestly, a lot of people don't want to pay because they're paying enough on contract as is. So.
Well, I guess so. I'm in the, maybe it's not so unusual position, but I tend to favour pay-as-you-go SIM cards, which means essentially I can have handsets and actually logged into networks across my desk all through the year. I never pay a penny unless I actually use something. So I'm very used to the paying-as-you-go model. I pay for on a call, I pay the 25p. I might send a text, I pay the 12p. I want to voice navigate for a week, I pay the £4.50. I think that's a very valid way of going forward. Rafe, any thoughts?
Yeah, just a couple of things sort of has come to mind as you two are saying. I agree with both of you in different ways. But I think it's important to remember that different people want different models. And so for, you know, a heavy sat-nav user, it's actually better to pay up front because they'll be paying less in the long run. Whereas I think the more casual users, which I have to say I think is the majority of the mass market, are probably okay with a subscription model where they just pay for the month when they're on holiday. I mean, I know I, for example, am quite capable of navigating around my local area without needing maps. When I go away somewhere new, I may want sat-nav just for 2 weeks, and so I'd rather pay, you know, as you say, £3 or £4, you know, a couple of times a year to be able to do that. And it will cost less in the long run. And as Stefan rightly says, some people want it free. But what I think is quite interesting about Nokia Maps, there's actually two things. Firstly, just briefly, is the license issue. One of the things I do like about it is it's the license is linked both to the phone and the SIM card. But what this means, if you put the SIM card into a new phone and then press update license from the menu, it'll actually update your license based on your SIM card. And that's partly to do with the fact that payment is linked through the SIM card. And therefore you can transfer it to another device very easily, which is something into contrast to the Engage we were talking about earlier. But the other thing I think is interesting about Nokia Maps is it basically follows the freemium model, which we're seeing increasingly on the internet. And I know Wired wrote an article about this a few months ago. And basically freemium means you give away a certain amount of the product for free and then you make the premium features pay for. Whether Nokia Maps has got the balance right, personally, actually, what I'd have done if I was them is I'd have provided the route finding more obviously as a free function. It is actually in Nokia Maps too, for those who want to use it, but it's not immediately obvious the way you access it. You basically have to click the central key and click Add to Route, and I'd have put a very obvious way of doing it. And I'll just have the voice navigation as the pay-for upgrade, and there's also city guides and traffic, and I'm quite happy having those as premium versions. But I do think this freemium model, whereby you provide a certain amount for free, and you know, in one sense, Google's doing exactly the same thing, although I think it has a higher emphasis on free than perhaps Nokia does, makes absolute sense, and I think we'll get a lot more people using these services. So, I mean, I'm another one who's actually a fan of the Nokia Maps pricing model. Perhaps if they were they were wise, they'd also offer a lifetime subscription or a longer subscription. They cut out the 3-year one, which I know has annoyed some people. And so perhaps they should offer, you know, some kind of lifetime subscription as well. So I do feel that £50 or thereabouts for 1 year is quite excessive for heavy navigation users, especially if you're paying that every year. So, you know, it does swings and roundabouts, and as I say, it certainly does depend on the sort of person you are, what you're looking for. But I think Nokia Maps is best suited to the mass market, and after all, that's where the most users are, and that's where the most money is. So I think Nokia's been pretty savvy in this.
Okay, just one more factor, again, in favour of the Nokia Maps model, which people may not think about. The hardened sat-nav user who use it every day and also who specifically knows they're going to stick with the same device for a year or two, then yes, it makes sense to go for a commercial package where they don't have to keep reactivating on different devices. If you're anything like the average power N-series, E-series, S60, what a smartphone user, you're actually going to be upgrading your device probably twice a year, I'd say, on average. And having something like Nokia Maps, you don't have to worry about which device. You can have device A, device B, device C. They can all be running Nokia Maps. Then you can keep all of them up to date with the very latest betas, the latest releases, the latest downloads. And you just, as I say, you simply pay for the voice guided bit on the device you happen to be using at the time you need it. So the commercial thing applies to someone who has a device for longer periods and uses it intensively. For all other use cases, I'd argue that the Nokia Maps model makes more sense. Stefan, you wanted to jump in on this?
Yeah, I just wanted to comment that the actual definition of software is changing rapidly, and in the sense I mean Google Maps on your phone and Nokia Maps on your phone, they're accompanied by a software application. Well, actually, one is in the browser, but eventually the entire OVI strategy will be about having an application on your computer, a service on the internet, and an application on your phone. And if they made the application on the phone free, really, where it's supposed to count, and made sponsored advertisements or pay features on the software side for computer usage, then I would be much more willing to pay for that, because when I'm on my phone, I want to find something, you know, ASAP. I'm not really browsing for anything. When I'm at home trying to route my plan, that's when I'm browsing for points of interest and all that. And if they add sponsored points of interest, I don't mind, honestly. It's just when I'm on my phone, I want a free application that can do everything that I need it to do. And
Rafe?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Stefan's really hit the nail on the head there, and it's really worth underlining the fact that, you know, Maps is a central part of Nokia's strategy, and there's a lot more to come from Maps on OVI, you know, syncing up to the PC and up to the web, and I think that will add a lot of extra value, as Stefan says, and there's all sorts of interesting business models that could come out of that. So, you know, I think watch this space, because this is going to continue to evolve. Also, I think it's worth saying that Nokia have also been smart in the way they're doing the maps. It's a hybrid service. You can either download them over the air or preload them onto your phone. So, you know, if you're in an area with bad connectivity, you can still have your maps, which is something you can't do yet with Google Maps. And of course, if you're on a limited data contract, that's also important. But yeah, you know, absolutely, Stefan. You know, I don't think we can stress that enough, just how important it is going to be to get all the other elements in place, because that's really going to make for the user experience that just you don't have anywhere else at the moment. And you know, I think will make a really significant difference to the uptake, because people find it easy to use and enable functionality that just isn't really there at the moment. Although talking about the future, I'm really excited to see that, and I think that's, you know, perhaps one of the hottest areas that we'll see emerge over the next 6 months to a year.
And I think it's absolutely vital to underline that the pricing structure on Nokia Maps at the moment, I cannot for the life of me see it staying the same, say, in 12 months' time. There's the huge gorilla in the room, as they say, in terms of Google Maps for mobile. I cannot conceive that Google Maps for mobile won't add some kind of basic turn-by-turn real-time navigation. They've got clients on S60, Windows Mobile, iPhone, everything else under the sun, and they're all native clients with access to built-in GPS. And they must surely add turn-by-turn instructions, at which point things like Nokia Maps are going to have to revise their pricing structure and change. And yes, as Stefan and Rafe have said, build it into the Ovi model, the software and services online and locally on the handset, and build it all into an integrated experience and making money where they can make money. At the moment, they're making some money from voice navigation subscriptions at the end user level by power users and early adopters. But as more and more software offerings like Google Maps come on the market, I think this is going to change and Nokia will have to reduce their prices significantly. Stefan, you've got a stat for us?
Yes. As of Q1 2008, Nokia has made roughly 85 million euros on software and services, which is a far cry from the levels they want to reach by 2010, which I think is 1 billion. I could be wrong on that.
Yeah, no,
but,
that's right to me.
Yeah. So, how will they reach from sub 100 to, 1 billion is really hard for me to understand right now.
Well, actually, interestingly, I think one of the things they're going to have to do is partner with operators, because, we talk quite a lot about, how it's Google and Nokia. Operators are, of course, still involved in all of this. And I think the truth is, you're not going to see one port party emerge as dominant. And just in relation to this week, there was an announcement between Orange and Nokia. There's a three-year strategic partnership which will see Orange take a range of phones from Nokia to put into their signature program, and basically that's the sort of premium or the hero devices, as Orange call them, that go onto their various networks. And they have sort of roughly 160 million people around the world on Orange networks. And as I say, it's a three-year partnership, and they're going to be taking Nokia services and combining them with Orange to create a sort of offering that will be Orangeified and branded Orange, but will be co-branded with Nokia. So there'll be things like Nokia Maps. It's actually going to be Orange Music rather than Nokia Music in the most likely situation. But what's interesting about that, there was a stat there in that press announcement about Orange and Nokia and their strategic agreement, was that Orange and Nokia see 10 million users of Nokia Maps on the Orange network on Nokia devices. Now, as I say, it's about 160 million at the moment. That'll probably increase by 2010, which is when this figure was for. But 10 million of 160 million is quite significant, especially when you consider that Nokia is presumably only going to be around 30 to 40% of those handsets. So that's 10 to 15% active user base on Nokia Maps, and if they can mirror that elsewhere, then I think the service revenue and can build up over time. But I think partnering with operators will definitely have to be the way to go.
Yeah, and of course they've still got to work out a way of rationalising the, was it 8 billion they paid for Navteq a year ago? They've
still got to go through competition approval with the EU. It's pretty obvious when we start talking about this map stuff why Nokia bought Navteq, and it still strikes me as a very smart move. It's the DNA for this next generation location and mapping stuff. And yes, we'll have to watch this space because that's still ongoing at the moment.
Yeah, the technology just moves so fast in this world. Just a final boot note before we close. It's just the sheer pace of things. I think Rafe and I are sort of sitting here in our offices this week just watching software items, hardware items, news stories just breaking around the web. Sometimes it just leaves you breathless, and I don't think the pace is going to let up anytime soon in 2008. I hope you've enjoyed this All About Sim and Insight. We've covered quite a lot. It's goodbye from me, Steve Litchfield.
Goodbye from me, Rafe Blanford.
And goodbye from me, Stefan from Finland.
Hi, it's Rafe here with a post-production addition to this podcast. As you know, we record the podcast in advance, and as a result, the news sometimes catches up with us. An example of this from this episode is the Engage Games Transfer issue. After we recorded the podcast, later in the afternoon, Nokia released a statement on the Games Transfer issue, in which they said that Games Transfer would now be allowed. Initially, this is to be done through Nokia Care, but in the future, they're working on a longer-term solution. It's great news and a quick response by Nokia. We'll discuss this more in the next podcast.